Welcome to the Tech Policy Podcast, your source for policy rants and raves from Tech Freedom, your Washington, D.C. advocate for the freedom to tinker and innovate. I'm Evan Schwartzschreiber, your host. On today's show, broadband deployment and adoption in Native American lands. Joining me in our D.C. studio to discuss this is Jim Dunstan, the founder of the Mobius Legal Group. Jim, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Evan, for having me.
And also joining me is social assassin and president of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka. Baron, thank you for joining me.
I would laugh, but I'm not sure what that means.
Well, let's get right into it. So, Jim, before we delve into the issue, how did you get involved in issues of broadband deployment and on tribal lands?
So, Evan, I've spent almost all of my 30-plus year career sort of on the cutting edge of technologies, and both in telecommunications and computer game and in outer space law. And I had the opportunity about 7 or 8 years ago to help the National Congress of American Indians write the comments for the National Broadband Plan that the FCC adopted in 2010. I then had the opportunity to do some work for the Navajo Nation, and I've represented now a number of other tribes over the years. And so it's been really interesting for someone sort of mid-career to suddenly look in the rearview mirror and, having seen all this great technology, realize in the rearview mirror that there are third world countries, you know, within our own borders here in the United States.
It reminds me of that great William Gibson line where he said, the future is already here, it's just not very evenly distributed yet.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, let's get exactly to that issue. According to the latest FCC data, 41% of residents on tribal lands lack access to a broadband connection, so the adoption number could be even lower than that. And that's compared to 10% in the United States as a whole. So, Jim, why is there such a disconnect, pardon the pun?
So, I wish there was an easy answer to that, but it's complicated, and it's sort of, you know, multiplicative in terms of why that hasn't happened. I mean, first, you have to understand that telecommunications in this country was rolled out by private companies to those who would pay for it. I mean, it's not like electricity or water or other municipal services that are generally provided by the government. It's all right. Done by private company. And so they have traditionally rolled out service to only those people who are willing to and able to pay for it. And so you've got two huge factors in Indian country. First is the very, very low population densities on most reservations. Secondly is the very, very low incomes of most Native Americans living on reservations. And then third, if you look geographically where most of the reservations are, they're in horribly difficult places to build, really rugged terrain. If you look at the Navajo Nation, for example, it's the size of West Virginia, and yet you have mountain peaks and valleys, places where it's really expensive to string wires.
So, yeah, you've got the problem of a lack of demand, is that, as you said, people who are not necessarily willing or able to pay for it, coupled with just a really, really difficult terrain, and the costs are really, really high. What is being done now to address this problem?
Well, historically, the FCC has had what's known as the Universal Service Fund, and that is, you know, that really substantial amount on your telephone bill that you see in the bottom line, that where the FCC...
That's
18%. The factor is now at 18%. And so the FCC charges everybody in the country a fee, and that goes into this giant pool, which is estimated to be $9.4 billion this year. And then it's allocated back out under four different programs. Under the Universal Service Fund, there's the high cost program, and that goes directly to carriers to sort of subsidize their building out. The second one is the Lifeline program, and that's a subsidy to individual users. And I want to get back to that a little bit later. The third is the E-Rate program, or the Schools and Library program, which subsidizes connections to schools and libraries. And finally, the rural health care, which is really, it's a pretty small, it's only a couple, small, a couple hundred million, but, you know, compared to $9.4 billion, that's a you know, small drop in the water. So those are the main programs that the FCC uses to try to incentivize carriers to deploy further and further into rural America.
So as you say, Americans are paying 18% fees on their phone bills. I mean, their phone bills have been high, you know, for that reason in part. And the idea behind that is that it's going to work, is that that money is going to go to connecting the unconnected. So why hasn't it worked?
Well, by and large, it has worked. I mean, we now have telephone penetration in this country at about 98%. The problem is, in Indian country, it's still down below 75%. And that's because that last sort of 1% of the population is really expensive to serve.
Right.
I mean, just for example, if you're a carrier in the city, your cost to string that next wire to the next apartment next door is in the hundreds of dollars, maybe, you know, tens of dollars. But when you're talking about now the distance between two people on a reservation being 5 or 6 or 7 miles, stringing that wire out that extra 7 miles is incredibly expensive. And so it's just difficult to do.
And is the funding that comes through these universal service programs, can it be used in a better way? I mean, are there bureaucratic problems here? Is E-rate funding being underutilized? Is the application process too complicated?
Well, I think in terms of E-rate, you're absolutely correct. I mean, Commissioner Pai's dissent in the E-rate modification order of last year absolutely hit it on the head. You've got a system that is so complicated that your average school district has to hire a consultant to the tune of $50,000 or $100,000 a year just to shuffle the paperwork around. And if you're talking about a Native American tribe, and that's money that can't come from the funds, the E-rate funds themselves, it's got to be paid for separately. And so utilization on the E-rate program in Indian country is really low, but more importantly, the FCC hasn't even bothered to keep statistics on it. So we don't know. I mean, I know from my clients and from those that I've talked to that very few, relatively few school districts and libraries in Indian country participate in the E-rate program. Whereas if you look at a place like Chicago or New York, I mean, literally hundreds of millions of dollars are going to those places.
So Jim, what do you think is driving that? Commissioner Pai complains, and he was on the podcast last week, about the FCC really not focusing on rural America, including Indian country. What do you think is behind that?
If you want to know my real cynical reason for it, the Universal Service Fund and the statute says that the FCC will assist in deploying telephone and broadband to all Americans. And yet this administration has changed that to say that they will deploy telephones and broadband to 99% of the population. So there's 1% of the population that has basically been cut out. And that 1% of the population are the most rural people in the United States. And many of those, I think, are in Indian country.
And they're doing that because that frees up funding that then can be used to provide significantly faster service in areas that previously wouldn't have gotten as much money, like in cities.
Yes, or to be even more cynical, they're playing to their political base, which is urban and not rural.
And the FCC is supposed to be an independent agency, but we've talked in the past about how politics have increasingly played a pivotal role in these proceedings. And as you say, a lot of the people who support the FCC, more regulations, they tend to be located in urban areas, which are better connected and have higher speeds, but rural America kind of gets forgotten. And one of the issues is that the FCC doesn't see wireless as a viable substitute for wireline broadband, even in areas like Native American tribal lands where the terrain makes wireline just unworkable. Is that part of the problem too?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it certainly is cheaper to deliver wireless because you only have to put towers up. You still have to put a lot of towers in a place like the Navajo Nation, you know, the size of West Virginia.
Right.
It certainly is more cost effective. But then you have the FCC almost constantly redefining what broadband is, going from 3 megabits down, 1 up, you know, to 10, and now up to 25. And the problem there is, in order to participate in some of these programs, a carrier has to guarantee that they're going to deliver that 25 megabit download, and it just can't be done in Indian country.
Well, just to be clear, though, Jim, that 25 megabit threshold, that's the definition for the FCC's broadband report under Section 706. They've used that to say that broadband isn't being deployed adequately, even though there's lots of good news about broadband. But they've insisted that they're still going to define broadband as 10 megabits per second for universal service funding. So what's the problem?
Well, even at 10 megabits, I mean, it's very difficult to get on a mobile device, even you know 4G LTE, that's stretching the technology.
In a very low density area where you're far from the tower.
Exactly. And you've got to be pretty close to a tower to be able to get that full 10 megs.
All right, so clearly there's a gap here, and we've mentioned some of the steps that have been taken. What more can be done to improve deployment and adoption on tribal lands? There was a GAO report. What do you think of these recommendations, Jim?
Well, I like the recommendations. One of the major recommendations is that the FCC needs to work more closely with the Rural Utility Service, the RUS. And I've been at plenty of conferences where both the FCC and the RUS were there, but in many instances, they're talking past each other. They're certainly not developing educational materials together. They're two separate agencies who sort of shake hands at conferences, but as far as I can see, don't work very closely together. And I think that's really important because the RUS, Rural Utility Services, that's where the real money is here for capital development in any country. And that's where it's going to have to come from. And unfortunately, those numbers keep going more and more on the loan side and less on the grant side. And doing loans in Indian country is difficult because you don't have any collateral. Tribes can't collateralize their land because they don't own it. It's owned in trust for them.
Right.
And so the whole sort of economic model breaks down.
So we talk about how wireless is a potential solution to some of the more difficult areas. What about satellite-delivered broadband, especially for these really, really tough-to-reach areas? Is there more that the government, the FCC, other agencies can be doing to encourage the use of satellite-delivered broadband?
You're probably talking to the wrong guy on that one. I am not a satellite broadband proponent because in the instances that I've seen it deployed, it works fabulously for the first guy. It works well for the 10th guy. And by the time the 100th person comes on, everybody, it's just crap.
So the signal just gets too diluted?
The pie just gets sliced too thin. And there just isn't enough capacity, because it's a, multi-point situation. You've got a huge funnel of fitting into that one channel of spectrum.
But there is some good news on that front, Jim. I mean, I understand that my old client Viasat has just launched a new set of Ka band satellites that would have hugely larger throughput. I think they're 3 terabit satellites. I mean, in other words, the technology does continue to get better, and as we're seeing launch costs fall, and companies like SpaceX be successful in launching reusable launch vehicles, we may actually finally see those lower orbit satellites that are closer, have less latency, that work better for things like doing VoIP over a satellite connection or video streaming. Are you not optimistic about those?
I'm optimistic but cautious because it's not only the technology problem, it's a marketing problem and it's a business problem because oftentimes you always hear the sort of up to speeds. Satellite carriers in the past have been notorious for essentially selling that same bandwidth 2 or 3 or 4 times over. And when you layer on all those different contracts over that same satellite circuit, that's when you start getting congestion and just slowing down. So there's got to be sort of a change in business practices, I think, from the satellite operators.
Well, there's some other good news. We talked about this recently on the show. The House Energy and Commerce Committee is pushing forward a bipartisan bill that would try to make it easier to use federal land for broadband deployment. For example, today, a lot of companies that have tried to deploy fiber, whether that's for backhaul, for wireless towers, or for wireless broadband, or for doing wireline service, have run into problems just getting access, getting stuck in environmental impact statements and historical impact statements. And especially if you're talking about Indian land, you may have other issues about potentially crossing tribal graveyards and so on. And this bill is intended to make that easier. So are people talking about that in Indian country?
Absolutely. One thing that tribes do recognize is the rights of way problems for most reservations, especially the larger reservations, are humongous. They're horrible. They know that they've got a problem. And both this bill, as well as the recently passed bill, allowing tribes to not have to go allow them to do leases without having to be approved by BIA is a huge step forward. But things work slowly sometimes on reservation. I know in several instances, even though a tribe may have authority to do leasing and do rights of way without getting the BIA involved, they're slow to come around to doing that just because they've done it a certain way for so many generations. Change is difficult. And yet, on the other side, there are those within tribes who recognize that that's the one thing that they could do to make it so much easier for tribes, for carriers to come on.
So, Jim, how does this work? I mean, states have their own telecom regulators. Do tribes?
Actually, the Navajo Nation is the only tribe, and I represent the Navajo, the Navajo Nation Telecommunications Regulatory Commission. They have their own little FCC, and they have their own Navajo statutes and their own regulations. And it's the first tribe to sort of begin to try to exercise a little bit of tribal power. And by the way, the New Mexico PUC, as well as the Arizona Corporation Commission that sits the Arizona PUC, are very supportive of the Navajos stepping up and doing some of their own regulation.
And is that a good thing? What does it mean for the average user on the tribal lands?
I think it's a very good thing. We've seen on Navajo telephone penetration in 2000 was still below 50%. It's now it's at 75%. And some of that is attributable to having a certain regulatory, so carriers know who they're being regulated and what the regulations are. Because otherwise, it's pun fully intended, it's the Wild West out there and has been for many, many years.
And they're also regulating the rates that are charged for access to lands that might be owned by the tribe or the federal government.
Yes, only rates as to towers and things like that, not carrier rates. Navajo have been very careful to say that they're not getting into rate regulation of either landline and mobile, which obviously they can't under the 96 Telecom Act.
All right, so there are some efforts to clearly address the gap. As we mentioned earlier, 41% of residents on tribal land lack access to a broadband connection. And one of these efforts is a conference that you just got back from, Jim. It was the second annual conference, Wiring the Res. It took place in Arizona, sponsored by the Arizona State University and the American Indian Institute, and it was held at the Arizona Gila River Reservation. You spoke on a panel. Tell us about the panel, about the conference, takeaways. Were you encouraged by what you heard?
Sure. The panel I was on was called Doing Due Diligence by Tribes, and we've got together a couple of experts and a couple of tribes that had done had rolled out their own services. And sort of the stories of how that happened. And the focus there was my talk was kind of doing a systems checklist of what you want to look at. Do you want to buy a carrier? Do you want to create your own carrier? Or do you just want to try and set an environment to encourage a carrier to come onto your reservation to offer services? And then we had a presentation from Nez Perce, which has done their own broadband, as well as the Navajo Gaming Commission, and they talked about their story of getting a very large pipe to their casino located just east of Flagstaff on the very tip corner of the Navajo Nation. And so the first day I thought was really interesting. A lot of good success stories, a lot of good discussion about how do we bridge this digital divide. The second day was the e-commerce side of it and what tribes can do about it. And I was actually very excited about that because I'm an internet geek. I've been with the internet since it got first rolled out, and I've always said I'm very encouraged about what you could do for tribes. The ability for native artisans to get their artworks, their kachinas, their rugs, their jewelry directly onto the internet because they make so little percentage from all of their artisan works because of all the middlemen involved. Well, as it turned out, the first half of the day was talking about tribes doing payday loans, 700% consumer loans, and why that is legal and should remain legal. And the second half was internet gambling. And I heard the term used, this was all about lawyer-created economic development. And basically, a bunch of smart lawyers figuring out how to find loopholes in federal laws that wouldn't apply to tribes. And I sat there sort of scratching my head saying, I'm working this hard to bring broadband into Indian country so that it can be used for payday loans and online gambling?
Well, Jim, it's my money and I need it now.
It is. But what you're going to have to pay back is your money plus a whole bunch more.
So what approach would you rather they take? So if their idea is that the purpose of deploying broadband is to have payday loans and internet gambling, I mean, what's wrong with that approach? What would you prefer?
Well, I don't think the problem with that is one, the tribes aren't actually funding these payday loan companies. They're being funded by white men bringing money onto the reservation and basically laundering it through the tribe. The tribe may own the lending company, but most of the money doesn't stick to the tribe. They get a small percentage of that. Same thing with gambling. The casinos, they've done better on in terms of having more of it stick. And at least there's some infrastructure there, requiring people to build buildings and provide jobs. But these types of online services are essentially, other than the servers being housed on the reservations, don't really build any economic development in Indian country. So I would encourage tribes to try and find other online businesses that in fact do provide jobs and do allow for sovereignty and do allow for them to develop their own citizens.
Yeah, and ideally, look, I mean, Jim's from Arizona, I'm from New Mexico. We are two white guys, but we did grow up either very near Indian country or worked with it. And I think the point here is that the internet has the potential to empower everybody on reservations, right, in a way that allows them to, if they want to continue to live in Indian country and yet participate in the modern economy. So the point is not just, oh, they could create cute wares, but they could do whatever they want, and just the way that everybody else can. It's the same thing that is true for a stay-at-home mom in suburban America in the Midwest is true for someone in Indian country. They could create a business and do what they want to do in a place that they love. And so the goal here from my perspective would be let 1,000 flowers bloom, do what you can to promote broadband deployment and adoption. And that means, number one, making sure that it's easier to deploy, not just through subsidies, but dealing with the very serious problems that we alluded to in the last show about deployment across federal lands. And then two, deal with adoption. I mean, we've touched on this a few times, but the data are very clear that in most cases, price is not the primary obstacle to adoption. It's a lack of perceived relevance. So it's not enough just to get people the service or even to subsidize them having it. You've got to have some kind of educational support for that, and that means making sure in the schools and in outreach that parents know why it's relevant and that they, as their kids grow up, are encouraged to get online, right? That's probably the only way you're going to bring the non-adopters in Indian country, just as in cities and in rural America everywhere, into the internet economy.
Well, there are efforts in Congress to make broadband deployment easier across the country, and we'll certainly be tracking those and discussing them on the podcast. But that's it for today's show. My guests have been Jim Dunstan, the founder of the Mobius Legal Group. Jim, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Evan.
And of course, our dear leader at Tech Freedom, Baron Soka, who also joined. Baron, thank you for joining us.
Thanks.
Follow us on Twitter at Tech Freedom or on Facebook.com/Tech Freedom. Find this podcast in the iTunes store or on your favorite podcast app. And if you like what you hear, please leave us a review. It will really help us out. Thank you for listening.
The Tech Policy Podcast is produced and distributed by Tech Freedom, a nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank in Washington, D.C. To learn more about our work, make a tax-deductible donation, or find other episodes, find us online at techfreedom.org.